Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. It is Tuesday, April 28th. Welcome. And we are going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 7A. And Wendy will give us a summary of the bill. And President Courtney, if you'd like to go ahead and come up here and end your 17-day standoff, you're welcome to join us at the dais.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 7A requires the Department of Administrative Services to procure or supervise procurement of information technology goods and services for the Oregon Health Authority. The bill has been found to have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact, and there are no amendments before the committee.
All right. Go ahead and proceed.
Chair. Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bugler, amazing. Vice Chair Rayfield, members of the House Committee on Commerce, Protection, and Government Effectiveness. My name is Peter Courtney, and I'm a state senator in District 11, which is portions of Salem. Then you go up I-5, and you get a little bit of Jervis, Woodburn, and Brooks there. I want to say before I begin, I'm taken by this vice chair thing. The second time I was before the Judiciary Committee yesterday, and I noticed they have two vice chairs. And every committee over here, I guess, has two vice chairs, so I have to get used to that. I'm not used to that. I think we have two in the Senate. But I did want to recognize all the leadership that's here, Your Honor. So I did want to hopefully be very respectful of the vice chairs, and the chairs. So thank you very much.
I'll even let them touch the gavel really quickly just so you see the extent of their
priority. Let me hold it once, too.
Chair, Chair Fagan, if I might represent, you might go get two other gavels. So you have three gavels and just watch what happens with the two individuals that are flanking you with their gavels. So anyway, it's just a little suggestion. So I'm here to support Senate Bill 7, which I introduced on the House side, Senate side, excuse me, when I was told as we attempted to redo Cover Oregon, we had a little problem with that we had an issue with the Oregon Health Authority involving contract codes and that we should correct it. And we worked the bill on the Senate side and were able to get it out of the appropriate Senate committee on the Senate floor, and it came over here. We did not get involved in any kind of Democrat or Republican stuff or any of that, rural, urban. I think this is seen as pretty much something that we should do, but I will defer to the individual collective wisdom of the committee to see how you responded to Senate Bill 7. While working on Cover Oregon, and my staff, I want to give Betsy Imholt and Anna Braun in my office credit for months. They worked on the bill that eventually was involving Cover Oregon that headed out of the Senate and came over here. We found that some of their controversial technological contracts were actually through the Oregon Health Authority's contracting exemptions. So what we found is that some of that contracting that was going on was exempt from any kind of serious oversight or accountability. So when we found that out, we decided we wanted to close those exemptions, and this is why we introduced this bill that has the Oregon Health Authority contract under the Public Contracting Code and under the supervision of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, DAS. This will ensure more oversight and accountability. Now, I do not like to read my testimony. I don't like speeches where I read, so I'll just simply say that this bill is very wonky, and it's filled with technological words, none of which I understand or can explain. That's a signal, Chair. So I brought the Legislative Council, the person of Lori Freeman here, who put this bill together and understands every word, every syllable, every sentence. What lies underneath the technological jargon and agency initials is a solid, necessary, good government bill, and I hope you will be able to support it. Again, this is a wonky bill. It's a very technical bill. We are attempting to have greater oversight over the Oregon Health Authority's contracting so that we know what they're doing before they do it, and we also know what they're doing when they're doing it, as well as know what they're doing after they're doing it. So that's why I've come here today. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to come and testify in support of Senate Bill 7.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Legislative Council. I'm just here in case you have questions.
Okay, questions for this panel? Well, I'll kick us off. So, I mean, it looks to me from looking at the bill that is the operative section, page 3, line 29. That's the part basically saying that the agency can't set a different price agreement if the director has already said. I mean, is that kind of, I mean, obviously there's a lot of kind of language cleanup throughout, but is that kind of part of the crux of it right there?
Madam Chair, that actually the crux is on line 20.
Okay. It's deleting the section that deletes?
Yeah, OHA is to have an exception from the requirement for technology procurement. And so this takes out their exception. So now they're subject to DAS oversight.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Thank you. I know that there's a few other bills in the legislature that are also dealing with especially IT contracting. One came out of this committee and is down on Ways and Means that also is looking at making sure that the CIO's office is involved in reviewing IT contracting, and was wondering whether anybody's looked at whether this bill is, whether there's going to be reconciliation needed, I guess, at the end of the day. With some of the other legislation that's going on in terms of IT contracting specifically.
Chair Fagan, Representative Holvey, I did not draft that bill, but we do have a process in place for conflict amendments. And so there would be, before the bill goes out, there would be a check to see if somewhere it was, you know, the CIO replaced a reference to DAS. And our editors would prepare a conflict amendment. So I'm sure that's under control.
And just quickly, did Diane Lancaster, do you want to come up with this panel just since with DAS? If that way you could.
Yeah, we can wrap this up pretty quickly.
Make sure that we have all the questions answered. Thank you.
Thank you.
You just want to state your name for the record real quick.
For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at the Department of Administrative Services, and thank you for having me. In answer to Representative Holvey's question, we have been on our side looking at House Bill 3099 and anything to do with the new Chief Information Officer's authority. Basically, Senate Bill 7 pulls back all of the previously granted authorities so that it resets. And as House Bill 3099 and others might go forward, particularly 3099, we then, all of us, will go together, all the agencies that are subject to the current DAS authority over information technology, so that whatever happens, we would all move together, and OHA would, of course, be brought along with us because of this bill.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Holly, or do you want to follow up?
It does. That was specifically the bill I was referring to.
I figured. Further questions, Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. And I'm not sure who's best to answer this question, but my understanding is that one of the fundamental flaws of the Cover Oregon contracting was it was based on a time and resource-based contracts instead of a performance or outcome-based contracting. Would this affect that flaw that was instituted in the Cover Oregon contracting in the past?
Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler. I think the point here is probably been made that it brings OHA information technology contracting back into the authority that is exercised generally over executive agencies, and that oversight, current and proposed, would be there. I could not speak to, you know, whether this particular deal would now be seen with any favor or not, because it depends on the situation. But the point is that all current oversight over other agencies is, with the passage of Senate Bill 7, would be extended fully to the information technology acquisitions of the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for this panel?
Well, yes. Chair Fagan, I am very nervous now as a result of Representative Holvey's questions and Representative Bueller's questions, because having been here so long, I think I don't have the exact numbers. I always give that talk, and I don't recall what it is. I think there's 2,000, is it 200 or 300 bills that have been introduced, and I won't get into the numbers that we're going to process through. But what frightens me, Representative Holvey's question, is there's another bill out there wandering around. And so I would really defer to the individual collective knowledge, collective experience of this committee. Because we did this. This is the lead dog. Senate Bill 7 is the lead dog to really try to get this thing squared around. And if there's something else out there, Representative Holby, Representative Bueller, I sure hope this committee, and I know you will work real hard to figure it out and reconcile it. Because I don't want to find myself, because this happens in this process. I'm going to tell you, you have the best of intentions, but when you're dealing with this wonky technical stuff, you go on down, you pass a bill, and next thing you know, after you sign, you die. Das gives me a little call, or somebody else gives me a little call, and we're struggling again. It's not intentional. There's nothing malicious about it or partisan about it. It just happens. And so the Representative Holvey has really got me going, wow, where is that? I got to go out here. Where is that bill? What is going on? Was it 3390?
House Bill 3099.
Well, 3099. I want to know. I want to go back to my office, so I got to go to the committee. I want to say, I want to know what's going on with that bill. I'm not trying to be, not messing anybody up here, but I really want to know what's going on. So I thank you for your aggressive or your thoughtful or intense questions, Representative Holvey, Representative Bueller, and Chair Fagan, because this needs to be done right to try to fix this thing that we got into, that I got into it, we all believed. And this word, I didn't just use the words oversight and accountability just to do it. I meant what we said. That's what we got to get back here. And so I just want to make that statement for the record, Chair Pagan, no other reason. So.
Well, and just so you know, Representative Nathanson was the spearhead on 3099, so she would be somebody that your office might want to reach out to. She was the one that really worked on that bill. So. And I believe it passed the House already.
Right. Actually, I've been working on that bill since I chaired this committee last session.
Okay.
And so I really don't see a big problem. I just wanted to alert folks to it, and I will follow up as well with that bill's in Ways and Means 3099 right now. And so I don't really particularly see that there's going to be a conflict. I just want to make sure there isn't one. That's the only reason I brought it up.
No, that's
so, Chair, okay. Fagan, did you just bring that up to upset me to emotionally take years off my life? Did you just did that? Cause I'm,
No, that never entered my mind.
Yeah. Representative Rayfield?
Yeah, and just for a little clarification, I think Representative Holvey brought that up to actually kill your bill.
Yeah.
There's a lot of conversations out in the hallway that I won't go into, but and the way that I do interpret this is actually probably the same way, is that this actually would complement Representative Holvey's bill and actually bring the OHA under Representative Holvey's bill. So it's actually kind of a package of both that would help, quite frankly, if Holvey's bill gets killed because of some of your things you might be doing behind the scenes, this bill would still be a good addition. So I would also like to say...
I didn't follow that, by the way.
Fair enough. I would also like to say that the good senator here actually represents my parents, and so I will make sure that they know that you're doing good work here in the Consumer Protection Committee.
Even though I was not asked the question, Chair Fagan, Representative McClain has made a statement I need to comment on. It. Representative Holvey continues to concern me because of his remarks. Okay, if this bill, the Holvey bill, the Nathanson bill is okay, what I'm worried about now is just because of this conversation, I got to go back and check all the bills because I got to be. No, I mean it sincerely. I want to know if there's some other monster out there just waiting that's along the way that we don't know about. So I mean it really sincerely. Even though we have this conflict process, I just soon get it done here now. So that's why this has been an interesting discussion I've had. I did not expect it to go like this or to come out of this meeting this disturbed. Not that I'm not saying I'm disturbed at the point I need help, but maybe I do. I'm just saying that this little discussion here has caused me to want to go back and check any and all bills that could be affecting the Senate Bill 7 or what we're trying to seriously do here to clean up the situation. So, again, I've been fooling around a bit here, but I take it very seriously. I really do, because I got burned on this bad.
Mm. And just to follow up, I sincerely don't think there's any major conflicts. I just know that if 3099 does go forward, that it will envelop part of this bill, I believe, and so it will because we're integrating this chief information officer into oversight of most of the IT contracts. And so, I just put that out there because I think we're going to be working on that. I don't think there will be any problems with this.
There's also Senate Bill 1, which you've already, I believe, passed.
Well, it's been signed, right?
Has me concerned here, too, which was actually shutting down Carver Urban. So here you got Senate Bill 1. It's already made its way through, but it was significant, too. So there's that. But anyway, I don't want to prolong. I know you got a lot of work to do. I don't want to prolong this. I just think it's I just want to go back and do some checking of my own. That's all.
Okay, great. Any follow-up questions, last questions? All right, thank you, Mr. President, and thank you as well. So is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 7A? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 7A.
And I was thinking of a different Nancy's, contract, all contracts have to be uniform bills. So that's why I didn't intentionally not give you any credit.
No, it wasn't that.
It's mine.
I just don't want him going to Nancy, and Nancy's going to go.
Yeah.
Okay. So, with that, I'm going to open a work session quickly on Senate Bill 584A, just as everybody happens to be here. Might as well get that done. Give us a reminder what that is.
So, Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 584A requires a contracting agency to suspend the right to submit a bid or proposal for disadvantaged minority women or emerging small business enterprise that exhibits a pattern of failing to perform a commercially useful function. It extends the maximum possible length of suspension for violations. It requires the Oregon Business Development Department to revoke certification for DWMESB enterprises after performing an investigation under certain conditions. It requires the contracting agency to notify OBDD when the investigating contractor for failing to perform a commercially useful function. It allows OBDD to conduct an independent investigation in response to notification. The bill becomes operative January 1st, 2016. Declares an emergency as an effective upon passage. No revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 584A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield has moved Senate Bill 584A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none. Carrie, please call the roll.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Hi. Representative
Stark? Yes.
Vice Chair Bueller?
Yes.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Vice Chair Rayfield.
Oh, yes.
And Chair Bagan?
Yes. And I don't remember who was really... Actually, I think I'll let Lou, unless someone really wants to carry, because I think he had a really similar bill. So I think I'll let Lou carry this bill. So with that, I will close the work session, Senate Bill 584A, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 383A. Wendy, do you want to give us a description? Come on.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Bill 383A amends and clarifies requirements for bringing a claim against design professionals. It removes construction from the term construction design professional and defines design professional. It adds an exemption to requirements for public bodies and applies only to actions filed on or after the effective date. It's been found to have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Bueller, Vice Chair Rayfield. My name is John Larson. I'm a lawyer working at a small law firm in Portland, Oregon. I defend and represent primarily design professionals, typically architects and engineers. I'm here today on behalf of the AIA, the American Institute of Architects Oregon, as well as ACEC Oregon, a Oregon branch of the National Engineering Trade Group. Senate Bill 383 is really, not to demean it, a tweak of ORS 31300. And if you are unfamiliar with that bill, that's what is referred to as a certificate of merit law that requires that before design professionals are sued, a plaintiff's counsel must first consult with some sort of an expert and get that expert's opinion as to the viability of the claims against the purported defendants, i.e., do I have a case against them? They make that consultation. If the answer is in the affirmative, the plaintiff's lawyer files with their lawsuit a certificate saying, I've consulted with an expert. They tell me the defendant, design professional, failed to meet the standard of care and caused damages. It serves as a very low hurdle or gatekeeping function for lawsuits against design professionals. And that's the way the bill is written. Currently, the tweak that we're talking about here is to have similarly licensed or registered professionals serve as the consultant for the plaintiff's lawyer. Currently, the law permits plaintiff's lawyers to consult with anybody that lawyer, for whatever reason, considers to be a qualified expert to obtain that opinion as to the design professional's purported negligence. This proposed amendment changes that so that the plaintiff's counsel has to consult with a like-licensed or registered professional, so that a structural engineer is consulted to determine whether a defendant structural engineer failed to meet the standard of care. A landscape architect is consulted for a claim against a landscape architect. Ad infinitum for the design professionals that we have here in Oregon. So that's what this law is designed to do, is simply to have defendant design professionals adjudged early on by people who have the same licensure. That's all. I'd be happy to take any questions any of you might have.
All right, questions for this panel?
So
Representative Rayfield.
So when I looked at the original bill that was on the Senate side, it was really the you didn't have, I think, similar credentials. It was actually looking for geographic locations of people similarly situated. In litigation settings, it's often a problem on the plaintiff and the defendant side, quite frankly, and you've probably had to hire a lot of people out of state to defend these things because a lot of local folks don't want to testify against people who are in the committee and, quite frankly, don't want to be a part of the process. And so one of the concerns that I have is with similar credentials is that you're attempting to limit folks to a geographic location, which will actually increase litigation costs potentially. So I was kind of curious, based on those changes that were made on the Senate side and here, what your thoughts were on that.
All right. Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, I think that there is going to be some minimal limitations on the accessibility of expert witnesses in light of these changes. I don't think that that's going to be a major problem at all. A lot of what we're talking about in terms of similarly credentialed is that we need an Oregon registered structural engineer to opine about an Oregon registered structural engineer. It's not based upon the geography within the state, so long as they have some familiarity as to whether there is differences in the practice of structural engineering when you're designing a foundation on the coast versus on the mountains, Mount Hood, for example. So long as they have some expertise as to the specific circumstances, because the bill talks about did somebody fail to meet the standard of care under similar circumstances, and they've got to be competent to say, I understand the circumstances of this particular construction defect, and I believe that the design professional involved in it didn't meet the standard of care for those circumstances. But you are right, it does require Oregon registration. In my opinion, it's never been too hard to find registered design professionals who are willing to protect their own practice by pointing out the bad behavior of someone else.
Just a follow-up.
Cindy, do you want to weigh in on that?
No, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Cindy Robert with American Institute of Architects. Vice Chair Rayfield, I want to answer the question only because jurisdictional was a word that was put in by legislative counsel in the very first amendments before we even came to committee on the Senate side, were to remove that word. It was the wrong choice of word. And not at all our intent to say that you had to be from the same jurisdiction as someone. So,
yeah, And just to follow up, the legislative record as it's just formed today basically says Oregon to Oregon.
Right.
And that there would be a limiting of the access of experts available to testify. And what I will say is in my practice, in various types of cases, to have the ability to find experts that are willing to testify in a local jurisdiction is a, you know, that's a real issue. And so the underlying legislation, or actually the underlying statute before it was deleted, essentially says a certification must contain, this is current law, must contain a statement that a licensed construction design professional who is qualified to testify as to the standard and care applicable to the alleged facts. And so there's already a requirement in existing law that a licensed construction design professional who is qualified to testify as to the standard. And so there's already this in place, which doesn't limit our access to experts. And so the real question is the benefit that we gain from going above and beyond, which, and just for the committee's perspective, this is, you know, unusual in a lot of ways, in a lot of litigation. My big fear on this is now that folks are going to get in there, they're not able to find somebody immediately local who wants to testify in court, because quite frankly, most folks don't want to do that, because it's doctors become doctors to help folks. You know, architects or other folks do that practice. They don't do this necessarily to come to a courtroom and testify. That's not why they do this. So to find somebody, what I'm then worried is that to increase the expenses of litigation at the very beginning is that motions, expensive motions, are then going to get filed trying to knock out whether this expert was actually qualified to testify, because someone's, and you can shake your head all you want, but what I'll tell you is that these types of things do happen in the real setting, and that's a fear that I have, that these increased costs will start to rise as a result of this, as well as the decrease. So, I mean, what do you guys...
So, Madam Chair, Vice Chair Rayfield, and you bring up some really good points, and I think we really considered them all. When we first passed this bill in 2005, Charlie Winger over on the Senate side helped us work with it, and then we tried again last session and this session again with Senator Prozianski working with us. The jurisdiction language, just to be clear, that we had taken out was because it was taken as a court jurisdiction, not geographic state jurisdiction. So that's why that language was taken out. Does it in fact require an Oregon architect to have been consulted to about an Oregon architect? Yes, and here's why. Even though we all have the International Construction Code, we have state building codes that's different and local building codes. And for an architect in Oregon to say to another lawyer, to a lawyer, this architect did not meet the standard of care, you have to know what that standard of care is in the state. Every state building code is different. Now, I will tell you that representative, that issue did come up, and the only group that we found that said, wait a minute, we have experts that aren't in Oregon, was ODOT, and that was out in New York. And that's why there's the deletion in this bill of what we had originally tried to do, which was include everyone, and public groups are not included in this, and public agencies are left out of this for that reason. We had no one else come to us and say this is a problem. Even the trial attorneys did not come to us. They had some changes. We made the changes there in there. I will tell you that I worry that this is getting bigger. All it is when the lawyer first files the claim, that lawyer has to say that they consulted with an expert witness. It does not. They do not name the witness. They do not say where the witness came from. They just say they consulted with the expert witness, which in this case would be an architect from Oregon against an architect from Oregon, engineer. And it doesn't mean that person has to be the witness. It doesn't mean that person's the sole witness or the only source. It's just a lawyer saying, I did this little hurdle to make sure that my suit has merit. And what we're trying to fix on is making sure that little hurdle is actually maybe a little bit higher, but a little bit more stringent, that you can't you can't say someone didn't meet the standard of care when you don't know what that is. And we felt like in the design world in particular, with the way building codes are, that we needed that same area.
just a couple more follow-ups. I think I would really make sure that you understand that the current law says that you have to be qualified to testify. You are not qualified to testify if you don't know the Oregon standards. Okay, so the real question to me is, why are we adding an additional requirement that's going to limit the expert pool? And ODOT has already basically confirmed what you've said, that we're limiting the expert pool, and so now you've exempted them from there. So why are we exempting the public who have a big interest in this? Why are we exempting them when we've already said, well, if it's not good enough for ODOT, why are we exempting the public from this as well? Why shouldn't we be, if we're protecting ODOT, we should be protecting the public? So that's a real question that should be addressed. And then the other thing is, not only in Oregon we have basically a coveted thing of expert discovery is generally, for the most part, we don't go into expert discovery. And in subsection A, we actually are now including a summary of the alleged conduct. And so not only are we now limiting that, we're kind of expanding that. Why do we need to add in now more of the summary of the alleged conduct above and beyond what is already in this bill? So that would be...
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rabia, let me try to respond. Several questions.
Yeah, oh, no. I apologize.
If I don't answer one, remind me, and I'll try to come back to it, or Cindy will. One of the issues that you've talked about is increasing the costs up front. And I think even Chair Fagan talked about expensive motions being filed. If you look at 31300, there's very little that can be done if it's defied, if a plaintiff's counsel cheats. All that can be done is, if the certificate is not filed, the case may be dismissed. But there's no questioning the merits of the certificate of merit itself. It's either there or it's not. And if plaintiff's counsel, if they don't comply with these requirements, there's nothing anyone can do about it. One of the favorite anecdotes or lines I heard recently was that anecdotes still aren't data, but I've got a couple of anecdotes. This is what I deal with. And when these lawsuits are filed, one of the first things we do is we get the lawyers, including the plaintiff's counsel, together with a mediator under the rubric of settlement, and talk frankly about what happened. You know, why did this condo leak? Why is this bridge cracking? And the only way that we achieve settlement is when there is a frank discussion among the experts, where the experts say to the other, I think your client messed up because they didn't do this. And when my expert hears that from a qualified expert on the other side, they pull me aside and say, we got a problem. And that moves cases to settlement and resolution. And that's the quickest and cheapest thing that we can do about litigation. That's much cheaper, I think, than any other change we can make to pretty much any bill dealing with litigation. Is if you can promote settlement, that saves everybody time and trouble and frees up the courts for more important things like our criminal docket.
I'd hope your own experts were pointing out the flaws in your own case as well, which should be spawning some it should be helping to settle these things. And the other thing I would note, as you are an attorney, the folks that do cheat the system, they get reprimanded by the bar. They get in trouble. There are many, we can't, as you know, when we sign our name on a piece of paper, we're attesting to those things that are in there. And so you're going to have bad fry cooks. You're going to have bad bankers. You're going to have bad attorneys. That's just the way it is. But there are rules in place to sanction those people that do cheat. What I want to make sure is that this panel here really understands that we as attorneys hold ourselves to really high ethical responsibilities. And when we do cheat, we hold them accountable. In fact, we publicly reprimand and sometimes disbar people on a monthly basis, just like in any other profession, medical or otherwise.
Chair and Vice Chair, I couldn't agree more with that. The one follow-up I'll make is that right now the law as written doesn't require a structural engineer. It just needs to be somebody that the plaintiff's counsel has concluded has the competence to testify. And when we go into these settlement conversations, too often I sit there with my architectural client, my architectural expert, and I have a building envelope consultant who is the expert for the plaintiff against my design professional. And that happens a lot. It's not wrong. It's not anything even worthy of bringing to the state bar's attention, because it's proper under the rules as currently written. And that's what we're here trying to change.
Representative McLean?
Thanks for your patience.
Oh, no, thank you.
You guys are both lawyers, right?
I'm gathering that Vice Chair Rayfield
is. Anyway. So I thought this. I thought I understood it until you guys both started talking to each other, and then okay. But let's see what. I'm going to go back to what I think I knew, and why I thought it was a good idea when I looked at this before the meeting was because what you're trying to do is just make sure that you've got the expertise in the room, or you've got the expertise at the beginning of the process, and that the expertise understands what is on the table. Is that layman's terms?
Chair Fagan and Representative McLean, that's my understanding, and that's what I'm desiring to accomplish here.
So the words on, I guess it's line 14 through 17, is what does that for me, and that is the part that changed over in the Senate side. My understanding is the wording. It's bolded there on page. It's page one, actually.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative McLean, that is part of the language that changed. And again, it's not that the experts have to be at the table. It's that the lawyer at the table consulted with an expert. So
right.
They're not actually involved. So,
and I get that. And I heard this whole discussion about they don't have to testify or they do have to testify. But, I mean, the person who is going to be there is basically contacted and or talked to somebody who has expertise in this type of design and this type of work.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, if that's an improvement, then I'm okay with it.
It's already the current standard.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Brett McLean, it is the current standard that they be an expert. I think that we would argue that right now the way the expert is in statute, it is gray, and we're helping to add what we think is an expert. That's someone who is of the same license and license in the state. We're trying to clean up that gray area. Madam Chair, if I might, I want to answer Representative Rayfield's question about ODOT, the public agency piece being left out. We were concerned about that at first, too, but we learned in the process when we were working on it with Senator Prozianski that most of the agencies have the experts for most things already on staff that can help and can say, yeah, you have a claim here as far as an engineer on staff that they would use. It was hard for us to let that go out because, of course, we think the same law should apply to everyone. That being said, we were informed at that point in time that a lot of the legal aspects on public contracting and the different limitations, like the statute of limitation, public agencies are actually exempt from. So it seemed congruent to us at the time.
Well, actually, let Representative Buehler get to his question.
Thanks, Chair Fagan. I'm going to go one layer deeper here. Is there any professional accountability with regards to expert witnesses provided by the professional organizations of the architects and engineers? We've had, in the context of that question, is in medicine, we've had problems for a number of years of so-called experts giving essentially false testimony that there's no repercussions both for and on both sides of an issue. And now the medical profession has a way to hold people accountable for just testimony that's clearly outside the scope of accuracy. So does that exist in the engineering profession and architects?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, I think you're talking about some different safeguards, and that's not actually one of them in this, although I will tell you that we have spoken about making this part of the Board of Architect Examiners and OSBILS, the engineers, to somehow have some say ethically over when this happens incorrectly. Is that what you're asking?
Well, not really.
So
anyone can label themselves an expert, regardless of their geographic location or even if they're a trained architect or engineer. But sometimes people will be in this world and clearly give testimony that's inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any repercussions in the professional organizations that holds people in Oregon accountable to giving accurate testimony in those cases?
Madam Chair, Representative Buehler, I would say that there's not actually a standard that's written into law, but I will tell you this, that we believe that by making it so that it's an architect making a statement against an architect, that because they have a license in Oregon, they have to meet that standard of ethics anyway. So secondarily, but what you're talking about, what you have with doctors, no, we were very concerned in 2005 when we first passed this law that it would spring up a cottage industry of folks who would testify and not be honest about this. And it's not even testifying. It's just saying to the lawyer, yes, this is a problem. Were we concerned about that? Yes. Did it happen? We don't believe so, although the architect who retires to Arizona and has lived there for 3 years shouldn't be able to say to a lawyer in Oregon that that lawyer did not follow the standard of care. So we haven't had a booming of people, but it is of concern as well.
Yeah, follow up. I encourage you because I've seen both sides of this equation where the lawyer thinks they have an expert that's going to give them wise counsel with regards to the merits of a case, and the person is completely off base, and there's certain momentum because of that. I encourage your profession to really look at a vetting or some types of accountability with regards to the advice that's given by so-called experts. Because just because you have a license, in the state of Oregon, doesn't mean that you're expert and that you shouldn't be held to a certain standard by the profession.
Yes, sir. That's very good advice, and I think that, though, if we're going to figure out how to do that and have that kind of repercussion or have some kind of, we've got to keep it within Oregon and have it be Oregon experts.
Did you want to pull it?
No.
Oh. And I would agree with Representative Buehler. I mean, that is, I think sometimes in varying fields, sometimes it can be a little bit fast and loose with some of the testimony on both sides. And that's important to have, especially when you have attorneys and clients that are relying on this information. That is very important. Yeah. To be able to have good information. One of the other things that I would note just for this panel as you go forward is, what does it take to qualify as an expert? And so if you're in a certain type of case, and let's say you're in a surgical case, and you bring in a pediatrician to start talking about a surgical case, all of us in this room are going to agree that that shouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. And you know what? The judge will agree. And this is very important. Mm-hmm. The judge will agree, and they're going to say that this person is not qualified to render opinions on these type of things. So there are already procedural issues in place to address this. The law in here already addresses that. And so my main concern, and this is something you guys can get back to me, is that if the state has determined that this is not good for them, why is it good for the public? And that's something that that's something that I'd like to get a better handle on, because the way I'm seeing it, I'm kind of falling, you know, trying to understand, you know, that difference. And, you know, I think it should be probably uniform all the way around. I wouldn't want to, you know, allow the state to have this access and then limit the access to justice to the public as well, or their ability to get a qualified expert. So.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Rayfield, I just want to be sure and set forth for the committee that this is not an expert witness as far as someone who's named, so we'll never know. There's no way for us to say, gosh, did you consult someone in a cottage industry? Gosh, is this person really an expert? It's such a small hurdle, and all it is a lawyer saying that they consulted with someone. Do I wish it could be bigger? Yes. Do I wish it could apply to public contracting as well? Yes. This is the shape of what we were given on the Senate side. I think it's a vast improvement over what we already had, because we had too much gray area. And saying that people have to be licensed in Oregon brings us a little bit firmer in the realm of what kind of person did you consult.
So I have a few questions myself. I was just wanted to see, and a couple of mine got addressed. I think what I still don't understand is, what's the problem? Like you mentioned that you've had cases where this other kind of, but you haven't mentioned that the geographic part really bothers me, because I find that, I mean, and Cindy, you've said, you know, all that the engineer or the professional has to say is, oh, this is bad. But what they actually have to say is that this person, they have to actually state that the alleged conduct of the design professional failed to meet the standard of professional care and skill. And again, in these small groups, whether it's doctors or other, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I would never want to testify. I don't even know if they didn't commit malpractice. I don't want to testify against another lawyer. I have to see them at bar events. And so making it be someone who's in Oregon, I have a really just big problem with that. So in terms of identifying the problem, because I already see this, I mean, I don't do any malpractice or any kind of litigation, but I see this as already as a huge hurdle. Like, there are very few other areas of the law where the plaintiff has to, before they can even file, has to do anything more than just fact pleading, where they have to actually go in and say, yeah, I've consulted with an expert. The expert agreed the standard wasn't met. So to me, what exists already is a huge hurdle compared to, and we just did debt buyer stuff in this committee, where, like, you know, debt buyers can go to consumers and have zero requirements to just file a lawsuit. So having any requirements before filing a lawsuit, to me, is already a very unusual hurdle. So can you help me understand what's wrong with the way it's happening right now? What's the bad outcome? Are there just floods of lawsuits against design professionals because lawyers are out there consulting people that you don't think are qualified? Like, what's, I guess I haven't heard yet what the problem is.
I want you to answer that, but Madam Chair, if I could just say quickly, when I said that right now they just had to say it was someone did something bad and they didn't have to pontificate, that was the current law. What you've just pointed out is what we're adding, which we think is an improvement, and I see maybe it's causing more problems, but the summary of the alleged conduct and the details of what that looked like is one of the things.
No, I mean, the current law says the alleged, the person has to testify, so it says they have to be, so just to be, I mean, because, you know, and when you guys came and lobbied me, I had concerns in this bill. So the current law says that the certification must contain a statement that a licensed construction design professional who is qualified to testify, so it doesn't say they have to testify, but they have to be qualified to testify as to the standard of care applicable, is available and willing to testify that the alleged conduct of the construction design professional failed to meet the standard of professional care applicable to the design, construction design professional. I just read current law.
Right.
So current law already requires
that you say something.
So and not just that they can't exist in the, like, they have to say, yes, they failed to meet the standard, and I'm willing to testify. Right. And I just think that's an enormous ask. Right. From, I mean, I could tell you right now, unless somebody, like, did a horrible, awful thing, I would never testify against another attorney in Oregon. Not going to happen.
I see what you're saying.
So I have a real heartburn about making this be in Oregon.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about the
yeah, sorry, I should tell you where I'm at. Sorry. I'm on
further,
page one, line, starting
yeah,
at line 21. 18.
So we go even further now, don't we, then? So I can see why.
Yeah, I mean, it just, yeah. I just, what's the problem? Like, what's happening that's so bad that we want to take what I see as an already high hurdle and make it, like, even higher by limiting this to Oregon? Because I do think that there'll be situations where they'll meet face-to-face with a design professional in Oregon and say, yeah, they probably didn't meet the standard of care, but that's Bob, and I see them every year at the annual design professionals dinner, and our wives usually sit together, and I don't want to testify against them. Like, these are small communities of professionals. So what's the problem today? What's happening that's so egregious that we have to come in and even make this hurdle higher?
I was going to say, Madam Chair, that what we have found, and this bill, the first time in this time, started with a group of people sitting around the table that were insurers, lawyers, engineers, and architects, trying to figure out what we can do to help with our liability insurance. So I will tell you, and I can have these people come and talk to you, but insurance, the people who carry our insurance said, while it wouldn't be immediate change to our insurance, it did show a mitigation of risk that they thought would be helpful, because right now, every time there's a lawsuit that has to do with construction, the net is thrown pretty widely, and we're often lumped in when we shouldn't be. This is the architects and engineers around that table speaking. And so this is what came after we narrowed it down, because there's so many things you can't do when it comes to narrowing the law and what can happen to architects and engineers, that this is what we came to based on what the lawyers and the insurance agents and the architects and engineers were saying. So, but I'll let John let you know if there's a problem he's seeing.
I want to come to that. Chair Fagan, and I think Vice Chair Rayfield, too. I think that I have a slightly different interpretation of the law as written than you do. As written, without the changes, the certificate of merit is based upon the opinion of a licensed professional. But it doesn't specify what type of license. So long as there's a structural engineer who's involved in construction, I would argue that that is therefore a licensed professional under the current as written law. That means that that licensed professional, that structural engineer, is now, so long as he convinces the lawyer, because he's worked on enough project, worked with enough architects, so long as he can convince that lawyer he knows enough about architecture, he can then offer an opinion as to the standard of care that was breached by the architect on that project. And what we're trying to do is say same or similar licensure, same or similar registration. That's what I view as the real meat of this change. And that's based upon my understanding of the law as written and based upon my experience with these plaintiffs' counsels dealing with these claims where the expert against my design professional is not a design professional. They've got some sort of licensure and they're involved in construction, but they were able to convince plaintiffs' counsel, acting in good faith, that they're going to be competent come trial.
So that I have a follow-up on that, and I appreciate you willing, because I'm not, I mean, this is not, I mean, I don't even practice this area of law. This is just one of those nerdy issues that you occasionally, like, dig down in, and I just have discomfort with it. So I appreciate you being willing to engage with us on such a kind of nerdy level, and I certainly appreciate the nobody falling asleep. The non-lawyers are just like, oh, my God, it's killing me over here. So what I'm reading, current law, it says the attorney has consulted with a licensed construction design professional. That's current law. Mm-hmm. But what I don't know is... is that a term of art? What's a licensed construction design professional?
Madam Chair, actually...
So are there a variety of licenses that are construction design?
Actually, there is statute that defines design professional, not construction design professional, which is one of the reasons we took it out of this. Just working with legislative council, thought, let's take that out because there is no such thing as a construction design professional. But ORS 671 and 672 are the body of statute that deal with design professionals, architects, engineers, landscape architects, program, I can't say a word.
What's the statute again?
671 and 672. Mm-hmm. Is that yours?
Yeah. So that's the body of who can be considered a design professional. So what you're saying is under current law, anybody from that category is qualified under current statute. Well, not they're not qualified, because again, I still read it as does Representative Rayfield, that they have to be qualified, but that's obviously a factual term that I guess ultimately the judge or the jury decides. So you're saying that anybody from that list could testify against, or not testify, but could provide this certification against any other kind on that list, even if they're not at the same kind of subcategory. And that's the current problem.
Yeah, Chair Fagan.
Okay.
An appellate court might tell me I'm wrong, but that's how I think it ought to be read.
Okay.
But, Madam Chair, we also did, when we first amended the bill on the Senate side, we had it everyone in 671 and 672 that this applied to. So that would mean a landscape architect can only testify against a landscape architect, a programmatic, whatever the... map people, the map makers are, photogrammetrists that are in your statute.
Wow.
We had all them in there, and Art Towers pointed out, wait a minute, this is just supposed to be the main architects, engineers, and land surveyors. And so we narrowed it to make sure that we weren't getting everyone who's in the 671, 672 design statute, just the three main ones that initially were part of this in 2005, because the statute has grown since then.
Yeah.
So is that the problem, though? So like a, I don't know, does an architect might be the expert against a land surveyor, and you don't think they should be able to be? I mean, I guess I still have a hard time understanding the problem. I guess you think you kind of hit the nail. You said it's basically insurance companies saying we want you to change this so that we can lower your premiums. That's kind of the base. So it's not like you're seeing a bunch of lawyers consulting with the wrong people, because in theory you're not supposed to know who I'm consulting with, right? Because I don't have to disclose.
Correct. If I can address that, Chair. Thank you, Chair Fagan. Again, we have seen going into these very early on meetings with all the experts talking about all the different things that are wrong on a project that there isn't a licensed design professional. I can't ask, and I never would ask, plaintiff's counsel, how'd you get your certification from Mary Sue over there? I can't do that. I have suspicions that I mostly keep to myself, absent public hearings, that it's not happening. I think it's not happening because these lawyers are acting ethically and within reason and following these rules that don't require them to have a licensed architect or a registered engineer to offer their opinions. They just need somebody with a registration or a license who's in the design construction field.
And I'll give myself one more follow-up, and then Representative Bieler has a question. But, I think I mean, I don't practice this area of law, but I do practice, and I'm always looking for my best expert possible. So I guess I have heartburn with you saying they're not coming in with very good experts, so let's limit who they can, because I'm wondering if part of the reason they're not coming in with the experts that we would then require them to be using under the statute is because people that are in these associations together that are in Oregon don't want to testify against each other. So my only person I could get was Mary Sue, who's a land surveyor, because all the actual, like, other, you know, architect design surveyors who I requested to be my witness, because I want my best witness, because ultimately, this, you know, in theory, this would go before a jury, and a jury would say, well, gosh, why is, you know, they're not going to find that witness. Even if the judge allows the witness through, they're not going to find, the jury's not going to find them very credible if they've never actually done architecture and they're testifying against, you know, I mean, so I'm wondering if the reason they're not bringing forth the experts that we're trying to require them to is because that's really hard to do. And so I just have a hard time, I guess, limiting it to only those experts when it might be really hard to get those folks to want to testify against each other.
Madam Chair, there's a cottage industry out there of a couple of architects that work solely for plaintiffs, or I won't say solely, I don't know what they do, but about the only time I ever see them is when they're across the table from me, making allegations against my design clients. They do exist. Are there enough? I can't comment on that, I'll be honest. But there are several out there, and on several of the cases I've described where there isn't one of those architects sitting there on behalf of the plaintiff, I don't see any of those, I'll call them plaintiffs-oriented experts, representing any of the other parties. They're just not in the case. And I don't think it's because they're shy about making allegations against design professionals. I'm just thinking they weren't called by that particular plaintiff's counsel, or maybe they were called and didn't couldn't give a certification. Speculation, though.
No, that's fair. I think this is going to need a little bit more work, because I just do have lots more questions, but I realize that we're getting towards time, so I want to let Representative Buehler weigh in here. Yeah. Maybe take it a little bit out of the nerdy lawyer world.
I'll try.
Okay, please.
I'm just sitting here thinking I'm glad I didn't go to law school. a couple thoughts. I think certainly the quality of my colleagues on the diocese with regards to their legal practice is different than some that we encounter in the real world, who there is a cottage industry of not only professionals but also lawyers who just facilitate these types of cases, and I see that in medicine. I think one of the hard things, I was under the understanding that this prevents what Representative Rayfield said, a pediatrician being the expert for a suit against a surgeon, meaning you couldn't have an architect being the expert against an engineer, even because of the too broad of definition that currently exists in statute. That's what I thought was going on here, but maybe I'm wrong.
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Buehler, that's my understanding and intents here as well.
But isn't it also true that it would, in his example, so I realize we're in the architecture world, but in his example, wouldn't it also prevent, let's say the case is a surgical case, wouldn't it also prevent a surgeon from New York or a surgeon from Texas from testifying against a surgeon from Oregon? It's not just, I mean, I see your point in terms of, and I think that maybe we could just define qualified better, but I guess where I still have a lot of heartburn is requiring it to be within Oregon, just because these are small communities. But in that, you know.
But I think in this world, I think a great example, there's some unique circumstances in Oregon, for example, like the road between Newport and in Corvallis, which you had engineer design build company from outside the area that doesn't know the unique geography and hydraulics of that area, which completely got it wrong. There's some Oregon-specific knowledge with regards to these industries that makes it very difficult for someone outside of the state to be a qualified expert to judge others.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buehler, I think that you're right, and I don't think it's only just a difference in what you know about the area, but we've also found there's a difference nationally in licensure for architects and engineers. Different states require different levels of understanding and different practice acts, so it's not the same either. So I think that we thought this gave us a better sense of who that expert witness was as far as their knowledge and what their background is.
I'm going to...
Okay.
You know, and I would note that the existing law, just so you know, that would already prevent, say, a pediatrician from giving, you know, an opinion in any case that you might be involved in over in Bend, like an orthopedic surgeon type case, because that person would not be qualified to testify. And being qualified to testify is current law. So a judge, no, a judge would kick that out in a heartbeat. And in fact, I've forgotten your last name, but you would stand up, you would object, and you would say, this person does not have the credentials, does not have the information to be qualified to testify in Representative Buehler's surgical case. And I should probably have used a fake name to, so I really apologize for implying that you would ever be involved in any case like that.
The odds are pretty good that I would.
Madam Chair.
But the, you know, and so I think what, and the other real primary example that I would get into is what happens in the real world, because as an attorney, you're going forward and you're preparing your case as though you were headed to trial, because that is a potential. And so when I go to trial, I know that my expert is going to be opposed against another expert. And so it is vital, it is critical that I find, as the attorney on both sides, the best possible expert you can find, because if I get the person who isn't qualified in Oregon, because I imagine these are many of the questions you would ask on cross-examination. I bet it comes right out of your cross-examination. I want to find someone that is qualified and will proactively address all of those concerns up front. Because if I do that, that means that my case has a higher likelihood of succeeding. And at the end of the day, a 12-person jury really gets to decide between these two qualified experts who have passed muster with the judge. And so I think, but I think it really, what we're looking at here is what Representative Buehler said, is there's an expert issue, right, on one hand, and then there is a potential legal issue of someone who's paying an attorney, potentially, and I don't, you guys would be better able to testify, someone who's playing fast and loose with some of these, the words, the current law. And so for me, it's not necessarily about changing current law. It's about looking at the attorneys that are playing fast and loose with the current law that we do have, because changing this law isn't going to change what's going on. What I think what we would have to do is look at what are, and from your perspective, it brings some real interesting questions when you do see these things that you go, huh, what's going on here? This doesn't make sense, you know. I've seen it too, you know, and how do we address that with that other attorney, and what are the repercussions that we can handle? I mean, what other type of repercussions and things like that? So it's just an interesting, it's a real interesting dilemma.
Representative Buehler?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Fagan. I don't want to be too far out over my skis here. Representative Rayfield, help me a little bit. But current law says, and I'm going to extend this analogy a little bit, that either a surgeon or a pediatrician can be the expert in this area. And that's what, because design professional is defined so broadly.
But it still says who is qualified. So it's yeah, like there's an initial category of people that is, under current law, licensed construction design professionals. And I agree we should take construction out if there is no such thing. But they have to be a licensed design professional, which is only a certain category of professionals. But then it says who is qualified. So they still have to be qualified.
Who says they're qualified?
I mean, that's a decision for the judge. The judge is interpreting.
The judge never knows who the witness is.
Chair, if I can be heard on that. The decision as to the qualifications of someone to offer that certificate of merit information is the plaintiff's counsel and the plaintiff's counsel alone.
So how do you end up knowing who these people are without going all the way to trial?
Well, that's what I was maybe not explaining clearly a moment ago. It's you go to these very early on all experts meetings, and there's no licensed design professional there on behalf of the plaintiff. It's somebody who does a lot of work on envelope inspections, building envelope inspections, somebody like that who's got a heck of a lot of knowledge about construction and procedures, but is not a licensed or registered design professional. The other issue about the judge's role, and Vice Chair Rayfield has made this point at least twice that I can recall, and it's a very good point, which is if you have an unqualified expert, the judge is going to not permit that expert to testify in a perfect world. Judges are humans, too. But assuming the judge gets it right.
You said it, not
me. He or she is. but the problem that we're trying to work on here is having gotten to the point of the judge making that decision is a year or 2 years down the road, a couple of $100,000 in attorney's fees per party, when maybe this all could have been prevented by this hurdle. We think it's small. I've heard some people say it's large, but it is a hurdle that may prevent the expenditure of hundreds of thousands of dollars if you look at a case as a whole. I mean, I've had cases where it's cost a couple hundred thousand dollars to defend, and that's just my part of the case. I mean, litigation, I think in law school I heard, is the sport of kings, because those are the only people that can afford it sometimes. And we're trying to have something that's going to resolve cases sooner and cheaper.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Fagan. And I play in this sport of kings as expert witness on the medical side. And what I see sometimes, in unlike things you two would do in your practice, there is a certain amount of fishing that goes on out there, meaning you act like you're going to take this to court, but that's not really the intention. The intention is just to drag this out, draw up the cost to looking for a settlement. And if you can get an expert on board early, then it just looks, there's a certain amount of poker playing with regards to preparation.
Okay. I mean, I have more questions, but I think we probably have exhausted this enough for the day. But we should talk more, because I just do, even that expert meeting, I have questions about that. But
Chair.
Yeah.
I think Representative Hovey had a question, and I have one more, too,
I
could waste time for.
Okay.
I did, actually, but I didn't want to interrupt this.
No,
this,
I didn't see you. Sorry. Make sure that I see you.
Legal discourse. Mine's probably much more simple in the world of construction and design. I'm curious, in some designs you may need an expert that has products or something that your design expert may be out of state. And so this bill looks like it would preclude them. Or, I mean, how are you going to say I have a, you spoke about building envelopes, because I have some experience with some of those controversies in the past, but some expert has a manufacturer and a design engineer that's a specialist in that particular installation process and design and how that gets put together, and it appears that this bill would preclude them as being an expert in this scenario. So I'm...
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey.
Am I missing something there?
No, it's not that you're missing something. In the current law, maybe this will make you feel better, I think that you've put your finger on something good, but on the second page of this bill, on lines 10 through 13, you'll see that there is some language there about if an attorney has made a good faith effort to consult with an expert and has not had success, that they file that statement with the end. The statute of limitations is about to apply, and so they had we thought there were some safeguards there when we did this, but I think the biggest issue, and you kind of get to it too, is we've determined that this really is a problem about the gray area, and this whole idea of who a qualified witness is. That's the whole issue, because there's no one to judge that a lawyer used a qualified witness. There's only what we thought was providing more parameters about what we thought was a qualified witness, which is someone from the state of the same license, because we believe that there's no benchmarks here. It's just a statement right now in the law. You have to have a qualified, you have to consult with a qualified witness. Well, what does that mean? That's all we were trying to do, is add to that. But I'm not a lawyer, and maybe I didn't do the best job. And I apologize if we've wasted some of your time, but I think that's what we're getting at. The whole problem that we're talking about here is exactly what we were trying to solve.
Chair, I just want to say really quickly that you definitely have not wasted our time. I mean, this is exactly what I mean. I'm sure that it's, this is exactly what we should do when we're considering legislation. So I've appreciated that you've stuck with us, so you definitely have not wasted our time. Representative McLean.
Well, I've appreciated the conversation about in-state or out-of-state because I think that Representative Hovey made a good point. There are some specialties around, and you may have one or two or three vendors in-state, and so you may, to get that expert level that you want, you may want to think about that. But the other issue, I'm glad for this panel that I am not also a lawyer, and so
really
I want to go back and just say I think that what they're trying to do is pretty darn good. We're trying to keep people out of the courts. We don't want to have to go to the court. And so one of the ideas to have this expert person at the beginning is to make sure that they're giving good advice to see if there is any real case there in the first place, from what I read. And so the whole idea is that if we can help them get to that, we've done something good. Maybe the language that's in the status quo is good enough to get the kind of witness that you're going to get in the courtroom, but this is somebody who's starting out before you've even filed. This is somebody, right, that you're going to talk to before you file. You're going to have to ask some questions about the actual incident or the actual design. And so we're trying to get to the point where people understand, hey, look, we really know what we're talking about here. And so, you know, I think everything I heard from you guys was that I agree with you that the present language may help you there in the court. Maybe we don't need to do it. Maybe that's redundant. But this is trying to make the bar further up the stream.
No, this is the bar's already there. Already this the is law. Just changing
you,
the
you
bar.
Already, right now, you currently already have to get somebody before you file. That's
They're just,
already
just, this is just changing
well, yeah,
who
you have to get. Exactly right. You have to have somebody before you file, and this is supposedly giving you a better expertise, and you're supposedly raising the bar. You guys disagree with that, but that's okay. But they're trying to raise the bar on the kind of of folks that you actually are talking to.
But and so just one last thing.
Oh, sorry. After his one.
Yeah, let me get Representative Stark in here. Well, Rayfield.
Thank you, Chair. I just, for the record, wanted to, since I hadn't spoken on this yet, and everyone else has
show that you're
for
awake.
So long, I just wanted to say last week I had a conversation with Rayfield, and afterward I was thinking maybe someday I'll go to law school. And okay. Thank you for reminding me today. Well, 35 minutes why I don't want to do that. That's all.
Job security for us.
I just want to say that I agree with Representative McLean that I think the intent of the bill, you know, I mean, the goal is to get the most accurate information. I'm concerned, number one, that when you limit the pool of experts, that hurts the public. And what the biggest concern that I have is on the second page, on line 19, where we exempt the public body. If it's not good for the goose, how can it be good for the gander? And I just want to say that quote.
I was going to say, with that, I have one more comment, but I cannot make it after that. Who can? But let's keep talking about this, because I agree with Representative Rayfield. The intent is good. I think it's just because it's such a legal procedure, which is, I think it kind of piqued both of our interests, because it's such a technical legal procedure. I think it probably needs to have more conversations going forward. But I definitely appreciate you guys hanging in there with us, and thank you so much. This is the opposite of wasting time. This is how we should be when we're considering legislation, particularly something that could preclude somebody from bringing a suit if their family member was injured or killed. Like, this is a big deal to actually, you know, vet this stuff. So I appreciate you guys hanging in there with us. Thank you.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
That makes three of us, I think.
Certainly not four
of us. With all due respect, I have to tell you that this was a bigger, more open exchange than we had in Senate Judiciary, and all those lawyers you think it'd be different. This
well,
is,
no, well, I'm not surprised. We're the House.
Well, of course. Okay, what do you expect?
What do you expect? Yeah. Cool. Thank you guys very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard after I think an hour plus? Is that, did we break an hour on that one?
Yeah.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate Bill 383A?
No.
Anyone. No. Come on. Anybody. With that, I will close the public hearing in Senate Bill 383A. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, just a reminder, colleagues, who are not meeting on Thursday, which I think, unless we get a flood of bills, will be a regular occurrence. So you can kind of tentatively schedule stuff on Thursdays during this time. Because at this point, we had to like ration bills to even have some for next Tuesday, because we're just not getting a lot from the Senate. So enjoy.
An hour on each one.
I know, that's why we can spend so much time. So with that, I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness.
I could do my law school studies.
this?
I could do my law school studies.
Consumer protection, government